Today we begin with Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflections entitled There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. We begin with our gospel passage read by Sean Patrick Lovett.
As Jesus moved about, he saw a man named Matthew at his post where taxes were collected. He said to him, "Follow me." Matthew got up and followed him. Now it happened that while Jesus was at table in Matthew's home, many tax collectors and those known as sinners came to join Jesus and his disciples at dinner. The Pharisees saw this and complained to his disciples, "What reason can the teacher have for eating with tax collectors and those who disregard the law?" Overhearing the remark, he said, "People who are in good health do not need a doctor. Sick people do. Go and learn the meaning of the words, 'It is mercy I desire and not sacrifice.' I have come to call not the self-righteous, but sinners."
One by one, the great springtime feasts have come and gone. Easter and Pentecost, Ascension, Trinity, Corpus Christi. And in place of the white and red vestments of the solemnities, we return to the green of ordinary time, a colour which symbolises hope and is everywhere a sign of new life at this season in the pale green of the tender young leaves. And with a return to ordinary time, we return also to the Gospel of Matthew and a significant episode in his life, the most significant, when Jesus called him and Matthew followed, leaving, with apparently no hesitation, his post where taxes were collected. Where exactly was this post? The evangelist doesn't enlighten us. But if we turn to Mark's gospel, we're given a hint. Jesus had just healed the paralytic who had been let down through the roof of the house where he was preaching. And immediately afterwards, Mark writes that he went out again beside the Sea of Galilee, or Lake of Tiberias. Now, in 1964, Pope Paul VI, on his visit to the Holy Land, went to what is known as the Chapel of Peter's Primacy at Tabgha, just beyond Capernaum. Here, at the lake's edge, is traditionally the place where Jesus appeared to the apostles after his resurrection and gave Peter the keys of the kingdom. A number of great heart-shaped stones, known as the Mensa Christi, the Table of Christ, are believed to be the site of the breakfast our Lord offered to his disciples after the miraculous haul of fish. But, as H. V. Morton writes,
"They are also, in all probability, the quayside stones of the ancient town of Capernaum. Each has a worn hollow in the centre of it made by the grappling irons or anchors of the fishermen."
And this is where Matthew comes in, as our travel writer surmised.
May it not have been on the quayside that St. Matthew was sitting at the receipt of custom? Until I came to Palestine, I imagined that St. Matthew was stationed at a custom house on the extreme northern limit of the lake, probably a kind of frontier between the territory of Herod Antipas and that of Philip, Tetrarch of Gaulonitus. But reading the Gospels on the spot, one cannot help thinking that St. Matthew was not on the road, but on the lakeside. "And he went forth again by the seaside, and all the multitude resorted unto him, and he taught them. And as he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the receipt of custom, and said unto him, 'Follow me.' And he arose and followed him." It would seem clear from St. Mark that the custom house was near the lake. If so, it was for the purpose of taking a tax on goods landed and a percentage of fish caught by the fishermen. The only place for such a toll house would have been on the landing stage.
For many of us, customs officers mean those unwelcome officials who greet us as we come off the boat or plane and ask us to open our cases or at any rate ask whether we have more than our legal quantity of liquor or perfume or cigarettes or whatever. It used to be called the Customs Shed, if I remember. But there's one magnificent building called the Custom House, which has nothing to do with what you can bring in and out of the country. It's more of a records office, as the Irish playwright Brendan Behan commented in Brendan Behan's Island.
The Custom House, as far as I'm concerned, is notable mainly for the fact that it was there I used to get false birth certificates in order to get false passports when I was with the IRA. It was burned by the Volunteers in 1921, and that's what brought British administration in Ireland finally to a standstill, for all government records were housed there.
Well, this Custom House, as you'll have guessed, is in Dublin, and a splendid place it is indeed, as Max Caulfield writes in his Guide to Ireland.
The Custom House is not only one of Dublin's two finest buildings, but it's among the finest in Europe. Its architect was James Gandon, a Londoner of Huguenot and Welsh extraction. The original idea was to match London's Somerset House, but in the event Gandon surpassed it, he chose a Palladian style with Baroque elements and used granite and Portland stone. The latter had to be replaced by Ard Bracken stone from County Meath during reconstruction work after the IRA set fire to the building in 1921 to destroy British records and render British administration impossible. The fire raged for 5 days and left the noble building a mere shell. Ironically, there'd been much controversy over its original construction because John Beresford, chief of the Irish Revenue who commissioned the building, was much hated, and Gandon himself had to use his sword to protect himself during the work. There was undisguised glee when it was realised that Beresford had chosen a muddy site on the Liffey, and it was forecast that the building would sink. However, Gandon laid his foundations on a layer of pine planks, and the scheme worked. When finished in 1791, it was hailed as the greatest building in the British Isles by any architect since Wren.
The best view of the Custom House is from the opposite bank of the river, and since its cleaning in 1991, it merits Caulfield's epithet of breathtaking. Matthew's place of work may not have been of comparable splendour, but if it were still there, it would surely draw the crowds. And Matthew himself, what manner of man was he? And had he seen Jesus before? Was his vocation a sudden blinding flash of light? He certainly seems to have had no doubts. H.V. Morton comments that if Matthew's post was on the quayside at Capharnaum, he'd have had many an opportunity of seeing Jesus as he arrived or departed. And he quotes this passage from The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah by Dr. Edesheim.
We take it long before that eventful day that forever decided his life, Matthew had in heart become a disciple of Jesus. Only he dared not, could not, have hoped for personal recognition, far less for call to discipleship. But when it came, and Jesus fixed on him that look of love, which searched the inmost deep of the soul, and made him the true fisher of men, it needed not a moment's thought or consideration. When he spake it, "Follow me," the past seemed all swallowed up in the present heaven of bliss. He said not a word, for his soul was in the speechless surprise of unexpected love and grace. But he rose up, left the Custom House, and followed him.
All based on conjecture and imagination. But we have no choice if we want to try and understand what went on in the minds of these men who just upped and left their jobs and everyday lives to follow Jesus. Although Matthew tells us nothing of his feelings, he does tell us that our Lord dined at his house. Luke, indeed, goes further.
In his honour, Levi held a great reception in his house, and with them at table was a large gathering of tax collectors and others.
Luke doesn't call them sinners, as Mark and Matthew himself do, Mark being more specific and explaining why they were there.
When Jesus was at dinner in his house, a number of tax collectors and sinners were also sitting at the table with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many of them among his followers.
Matthew himself writes,
"Now it happened that while Jesus was at table in Matthew's home, many tax collectors and those known as sinners came to join Jesus and his disciples at dinner."
These subtle differences in the way each of the three evangelists describes the people present at Matthew's party are very revealing. Luke, who was not an apostle or an eyewitness, clearly doesn't feel justified in using the term sinners, perhaps out of respect for Matthew. And Mark, though he calls them sinners, tells us they were followers of our Lord. Matthew uses the phrase, "those known as sinners," for they were, after all, his guests, whom he does not choose to offend, even in retrospect. When the Pharisees, obviously hovering in the vicinity, see the kind of people going in and out of the house, they complain to the disciples, almost as if afraid to confront Jesus. In the version of the Gospel we've heard, they do not use the word sinners, unlike the other versions I've read, where in all three Gospels the Pharisees say sinners. But perhaps this other version brings us closer to the real meaning. Those who disregard the law is not quite the same as sinners. The scribes and Pharisees were very legal-minded, as we know. The letter of the law, the ritual law, the Mosaic law was everything, and to disregard it meant to be outside the pale. And as for tax collectors, well, they've never been popular anywhere at any time. And where Matthew worked, as our travel writer comments,
"The place must have swarmed with them. It was a frontier district, and everything coming into it from the many caravan roads, from the neighbouring tetrarchy of Philip, or from the opposite side of the lake, was subject to duty."
In their accounts of his calling, Luke and Mark give Matthew his original name, Levi, today probably best known as a trademark. But in their lists of the 12 apostles, they call him Matthew. He alone adds his profession, tax collector or publican, an act which a modern scholar has described as the most moving declaration of humility. In that insistence on calling himself unworthy, sinner, impure, is all the greatness of Levi, the bound, who became Matthew, gift of God. When the Pharisees accost the apostles with their awkward question, you can almost see the sneers on their faces, our Lord intervenes to save his friends from embarrassment and to put the record right. Just as he heals the physically sick, he will do the same for those sick in soul. The Pharisees must have preened themselves at what they surely took as a compliment. They were not sick, they were righteous, self-righteous, we read, men on the right side of the law. But Jesus doesn't let them off so lightly. "Go and learn the meaning of the words, 'It is mercy I desire, and not sacrifice.'" Mercy, that must have foxed them. It certainly silenced them, for the moment at any rate. In his poem, The Divine Image, William Blake links mercy with three other qualities typical of our Lord in his dealings with people, and to be found, he says, not only in God, but in man.
To mercy, pity, peace, and love, all pray in their distress, and to these virtues of delight return their thankfulness. For mercy, pity, peace, and love is God, our Father dear, and mercy, pity, peace, and love is man, his child and care. For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dress. Then every man of every clime that prays in his distress prays to the human form divine, love, mercy, pity, peace. And all must love the human form, in heathen, Turk, or Jew, where mercy, love, and pity dwell, there God is dwelling too. Thank you.
There is probably no exposition of mercy better known than Shakespeare's, in the words he gives to Portia in The Merchant of Venice.
The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His sceptre shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty, wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptred sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings. It is an attribute to God himself. And earthly power doth then show likest God's when mercy seasons justice. In the course of justice, none of us should see salvation. We do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy.
Alexander Pope, in The Universal Prayer, reminds us to do as we would be done by if we would taste mercy.
Teach me to feel another's woe, to hide the fault I see. That mercy I to others show, that mercy show to me.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who produced and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye.